Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Writing the Rapids, the show where I, Joe Bilecki, talk to writers about writing. Very often those writers have been recommended to me by writers who have previously been on the show, or it's a rejoinder episode, but this is just one of the normal ones. We have O.F. Sieri joining me today. She was recommended to me by Sam Richards, so if you liked that one, stick around for this one, and if you like this one, go back and listen to that one. O.F. Sieri is a self-taught writer based out of New York City. She has been published in Ligeria Magazine and Misery Tourism. In 2013, she won first place in BMCC's poetry competition. In 2016, she won an honorable mention in Labor Arts Make Work Visible competition. And she has three books out: Backmask, Lockdown Laureate, and Lord of Thundertown. Before we get into my conversation with O.F. Sieri, how about I just tell you how you can help out the show? The ways with money are Patreon, patreon.com/noisemakerjoe. For just $2 a month, you get these episodes a day or two earlier than everybody else. Or you can buy my book. It's called Tired. It's on Amazon. You can also buy the compilation Unheimlich out through Soyos Books, which has an excerpt of Tired in it. Or you can tell a friend about the podcast, rate the podcast 5 stars on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, that sort of thing. Now, without further ado, let's get into my conversation with O.F. Sieri. I had two ways I wanted to start this, and I guess I'll ask you vaguely enough that you don't know what you're getting into. I had a serious way I wanted to get started with this show, and I had a less serious way. Which way would you like to begin?
I'm always going to go for the less serious option.
Cool. Would you like to talk about The Hero with 1,000 Faces?
Oh, you're getting into a problem, but sure, let's go. I don't think you realize what you've just walked into, but okay.
Yeah, I have seen posts from you here and there that you really don't like Joseph Campbell. And I can imagine why. But I don't have quite such strong feelings about him, aside from being frustrated that people start and end with him when it comes to plot analysis, I guess.
Yes.
And I'm hoping that this goes into like some Jung hate, cause that would be fun, but let's, as a person who casually sees your social media from time to time, why might I want to start the podcast by talking about this?
Well, it's because I fucking hate Joseph Campbell. and if you have a casual like understanding of my social media presence, you'll know that I have a background in anthropology. Mm-hmm. And as an anthropologist, Joseph Campbell sucks. He's incredibly lazy. He belongs to a very antiquated version of anthropology that was looking to find some kind of universal truth, some kind of hard foundational facts about human nature by boiling every single human aspect down to some elemental fact. And I mean, like, I even hesitate to say that that's an antiquated form of anthropology, because like, if you skim my social media, you'll know that I also follow, like, I am familiar with Victorian texts about anthropology. And while like doing parallel studies of different cultures was as common then as it is now, this idea of boiling down human nature to some essential fact was not really prevalent until the 20th century and postmodernism, although I'm not going to blame postmodernism for that. For the record, it was mostly just like this idea that we could do more with less was really foundational at the beginning of the 20th century, and people were really excited about the possibilities where that could go. And as a, I don't know if you can hear my wife yelling at my roommate, I'm sorry.
No, I can't. You're all good.
but as a result, it did end up attracting a lot of people who wanted to use it for lazy purposes, people who saw it as cutting edge. And so as a result, kind of equated cutting edge with correct, or at least with unassailable. And so we ended up with a lot of very lazy theories that kind of got stuck in pop culture. And I think that Joseph Campbell is this theory that was seminal because he did do a lot of reading, to be fair, and he wrote well. But his work doesn't actually hold up to scrutiny in any context, and it sucks that The Hero with a Thousand Faces is, you know, still seen by people who don't care about it as much as people who really love anthropology as an actual anthropological text. And it sucks that it's used as a creative writing textbook. And also just like as the basis for all screenplays in Hollywood, like it's so tiring. Oh my God. It's so tiring to deal with.
Yeah. I feel that from, I guess a different angle. I feel like it's personally even placed some sort of like wall in my imagination, right? Where like if I want to do something narrative, yet experimental, I still kind of like bang my head on like the three act structure, the, you know, The Hero with a Thousand Faces sort of circle graph that I see all over the place. And I guess it is because, you know, the story either is or has become ubiquitous that it's hard to imagine what a story could be like, but without it. But it is frustrating to, I don't know. It's kind of the same thing where it's like, well, there's only six stories and Shakespeare invented all of them. And so every book is either, you know, King Lear or Romeo and Juliet or whatever.
I think that's kind of a reductive way of looking at storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even if that's true, we are so different from Shakespeare. There's never going to be another Shakespeare again because it's just like all of the factors that went into making Shakespeare don't exist anymore. So what we're going to have to do is we're all going to have to invent something new regardless, just because we're all dealing with different tools. And you can, once again, you can boil down a story so that every single fucking story is Romeo and Juliet if you really wanted to. Like I heard this in a podcast, so I don't know what story this was, but somebody made this reference. I think it was not Acid Horizon, but this another literary analytical podcast that was talking about how Rapunzel is the story of humanity evolving from a single cellular organism into a civilization. Yeah, I don't remember exactly what the source of that is, but yeah, you could make anything, say whatever the fuck you wanted if you wanted to. I could say that Romeo and Juliet is secretly King Lear if I wanted to. I don't really see the point of thinking about that way. The point is, how does the author craft their narrative for the one piece of art that they've made?
Yeah. I guess, so it kind of makes me think about, on the more esoteric side, debates I've seen about perennialism with regard to like mystic traditions. And there's that analogy of like a whole bunch of people in a dark room with an elephant and they're all touching a different part of the elephant. But the argument against perennialism that I heard that kind of broke me out of my, I don't know, sort of naive agreement with it is, was a guy basically just saying that, like, for people who are really, really in a religion, their mystical experience is inextricably linked to the religious tradition they come to, right? So, like, a Jewish religious experience, a Jewish mystical experience can't be, you can't take the Jewishness away from that and say it's just the same thing as somebody who had a lot of DMT is just the same thing as a Catholic monk in a monastery. Like, there's a different texture to it. So like, again, even if the three act structure is, I don't know, is ubiquitous as Campbell wanted to say it is, like removing the cultural texture from it. I guess that's what you said about Shakespeare too, right? Like you can't remove Shakespeare's time from Shakespeare's work to make it into something else easily. And I guess that's why retellings of Shakespeare plays are so fun, right? Like the however many 90s and early aughts teen comedy romances that came out that were
everybody just, loves Romeo plus Juliet.
Oh my goodness, it's so fantastic. She's the Man, 10 Things mm-hmm. I Hate About You. It's fantastic, yeah. And like, yes, that's, I don't know, I've been having a strange crisis of confidence when it comes to like trying to think of new projects for myself, where I'll think of an idea and I'll be like, oh, but that's just, I don't know, Transformers meets Crybaby, and be like,
Why won't you do that?
Well, to be fair, I just thought of that now and I have no idea how that would look. So somebody else can do that. That's fine. But the point is that like, even doing the thing that like you're required to do to sell books, you know, you gotta put that on the back of the book or put that in the cover letter or whatever. Like it's been so weird for the past couple months that like, if I could do that at all with a plot that I had come up with, I didn't want to do anything with it anymore. And I don't know why that is. But I thought back to like the hero's journey structure and was kind of like used that to convince myself that like there was no reason to do anything that even could vaguely fit on it because it was already there. Which was, I don't know, that's unhelpful, I suppose, for myself.
I've been thinking about this a lot as well, but from a different angle, because I've been reading a lot of like incredibly old books, and I decided that I wanted to write something that was basically an incredibly old book and just be as unapologetic as possible about the fact that I was going to be writing something self-indulgent and probably derivative and to just enjoy myself and ride the ride. There were a lot of different theories about literary creation in the 1840s to 80s. And so people like Balzac, Gautier, and also William Morris had this idea that writing required material as much as a physical project did. And so in order to create, you would need to take in as much as possible. And this could also be a social experience, but it could just as easily be a created piece of media, and that borrowing from it was fine. Because yeah, like everything has been invented already, but once again, art is a conversation between artists. And so to deny yourself the pleasure of answering someone is just going to leave you silent.
I like that a lot better than where I was coming at it from, so I'm going to take that. we've had short exchanges, too, on Blue Sky. About like doing very pulpy stuff.
Yes.
And Backmask is I mean it's says pulp. Like in several places that it is like in the tradition of 60s pulp, which I'm unfortunately not super versed in yet. But I think veering into Backmask at this point is a good idea, because kind of the other place I thought about starting the podcast was in mentioning how when I talked to Charlene Elsby about The Devil Thinks I'm Pretty, I kind of raved for a long time about how it felt tailor-made for me. Scummy teenagers getting in way over their heads with maybe supernatural stuff is right up my alley. Well, turns out a more niche thing that I don't have the occasion to rave about is I really do love fictional books about musicians and the Western esoteric tradition. So you managed to make a book that was very much for me in that sort of way. I've had Dean Swinford on. We've talked about all three of his death metal epic books, and A.S. Coomer's Shining the Light, like way back in the first year of the podcast. And so it was nice to get back to it with Backmask about like just writing about music and writing about the crazy, strange, religious science type stuff people were doing in the 60s.
Oh, yeah.
And then kind of veering into MK Ultra there near the end.
Well, MK Ultra was literally related to it, you know, like I talk in the book about how I sat down and read Timothy Leary's flashbacks, and you were talking about how if you get four different people from four different religious backgrounds in a room and you make them all do DMT, they're going to have different experiences. And that's something that Timothy Leary did to an extent. Like, he talks in flashbacks about not four different people, but they got the seminary students from the college that he was studying in. I think it was Stanford, but I don't remember. It actually, I make a reference in the end of the book to which college, because they drive off into the sunset to that college. But they got the seminary students to take a bunch of acid and watch their reaction. No, sorry, mushrooms, because his studies were on mushrooms. And every single one of them related having a religious experience. And Leary was talking about how interesting that was, because like when he took it, he was aware that he was having a drug reaction. I mean, they were all aware that they were having a drug reaction, but they were like, oh, this drug helped me have a religious experience. This is what that is. As for like making a book about music, I thought that this was kind of like a subversion of that, because I very specifically made it not about the musicians. I thought that I was making a joke at the reader's expense about the fact that like the musicians are barely characters. They don't even all get names.
Mm-hmm.
like the fact that the producer character stands up in the middle of their performance and goes, "Oh my God, that's brilliant." And like the reader has no idea what the fuck is actually happening. Like, that was a joke on you.
Yeah. No, I love that. One of the things that I've talked to my wife about is this thing that happens in film where somebody is an unknown musical savant. And if you ever hear their music, it immediately shatters the illusion for me.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember what the movie was that like really broke it for me. But I don't, it was just something like some woman was just like playing an acoustic guitar on a rooftop party in New York somewhere in the movie. And
right. The
guy sees her and like the dolly zoom happens and his whole world changes. And it's just like a fine girl with a guitar song. Like, there's nothing about it that could possibly be earth-shattering. And you know, you can't exactly do that, right? Like, you can't, it would be very hard to make a movie about a piece of art that completely changes the game without just wanting to make that piece of art that changes the game. So I liked that.
The most obvious example that I can think of is in Rent, when they finally play the song that Roger's been working on throughout the entire musical.
Mm.
It's nobody's favorite song. Everybody hates it.
That's fantastic. So yeah, I like that there wasn't a lot of that, aside from the fact that I slowly came to realize that you were just like, he was just describing Bauhaus 20 years early.
Yes! Finally! Yes!
I was like,
I've been waiting for someone to tell me that they came to that conclusion. Oh my God, I can finally sleep.
Yay! I'm so glad. Yeah, I kept getting there. Like, he was describing it, and I was just like, what is that? That is something that exists. And then one of the characters says she's in parties, and it snapped for me. you tipped your hand with that one. But I was like, yeah, I think he's just describing goth music, which I guess makes it even funnier, right? That, you know, like, not even the music that causes the satanic panic necessarily. Like, it's not like he invented metal music or something in the 60s.
Well, part of the inspiration for the book was that a lot of goth music takes a lot of inspiration from hippie music,
mm-hmm.
from I want to say early rock and roll, but also very specifically like music from the 60s that was really inspired by psychedelia. A lot of the goths in the 90s were actually doing covers of the Rolling Stones and the Beatles. Motorhead did in the 90s as well. If you believe in the 30-year cycle of nostalgia, then that makes sense because mm-hmm. it would have been 30 years later. And so, like, part of the joke is that, like, he sees one song and he's like, well, I can see the future. So if I just recreate this, then it is automatically avant-garde. And it's not really anything like that special. I didn't even want it to be like their most famous song. I didn't even want it to be like Bill Lugosi's Day. Actually, wait, that's not Bauhaus, is it?
No, it is. It is.
Okay, good. Yeah, I didn't even want it to be Bela Lugosi's Dead.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess I just wanted to keep repeating that I very much enjoyed that. It was fun because, like, oh yeah, everyone's like covered in spider webs and the fact that he's going to the Institute for Metaphysical Research and the Masons, and it's funny to me. I just recently, late last year, I read a book about prog rock in the 70s, and they kind of came out of the hippie stuff too. So it's interesting to see the two paths that made. That's kind of neither here nor there about the book. One of the things that I really enjoyed about the book is that I don't have an awful lot of knowledge about modern Western esotericism. The YouTube channels I watch kind of stop around John Dee, and so everything's kind of older. And so it was fun for me to kind of connect some dots. The Gnosticism character was very silly, because it was kind of like, it's a correct interpretation of one of the forms of Gnosticism, but kind of the silliest one, or at least like made in the silliest way.
I couldn't imagine a way that I could actually make the Gnostics part of the conspiracy. And so I basically just wrote them out, or I made them kind of the tattletales of the story. I don't know if you know a better sect of Gnosticism that I might have been able to put in there, but I also felt like, I mean, based mostly on my reading of PKD, I figured that the Gnosticism that would have existed in the 1960s would have been the sect that I basically wrote in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're not very sexy, largely because they didn't do a whole lot. Like, a lot of them, more recently than the prog rock book, read a book about, it was made shortly after the Nag Hammadi library was discovered, and this early Christian scholar, I forget her name, wrote this book kind of looking at those writings and then looking at the New Testament and just like examining the political reasons why certain texts would have been chosen and some would have definitely been not chosen. And largely, like, Gnostics were not very hierarchical. A lot of the more extreme ones, like, were against having children because bringing people into this world that's like evil and bad and these people that would need to be redeemed, like, doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And a lot of them didn't eat meat and followed a lot of the more strict Hebrew Bible rules. And so basically the groups that did last until the Inquisitions were easily rooted out and kind of driven away because they really just kind of sat around and prayed all day and felt bad for existing, which, you know, same, but it's hard to build an exciting religion, whereas, like, you know, a lot of your Crowleyites and related people are interesting and flamboyant and sexy, and you see them and you want to figure out what their deal is.
Yeah, the 19th century occultists have been interesting to study, and I didn't realize, like, how much of Crowley's influence, and I've got some Thelemic friends, so I apologize if any of them are listening, basically just comes from him surviving into the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there are a couple of other reasons for that as well. Like, he did actually create a new cosmology out of his readings, whereas a lot of the other guys leaned on existing institutions. So, for example, I got Dr. Sasha Chaitow's book, Son of Prometheus, about Josephine Peladon, who was a incredibly famous 19th century French occultist. But he was also a very devout Catholic, which made sense at the time, doesn't make sense anymore. But he got into a lot of fights with the other esotericists and other occultists who were in Paris, because he wanted his occultism to be in line with the Roman Church. And he was furious that they were reading about Buddhism and Hinduism, and stormed off and went to go live in the desert for a while in Egypt, by the way. And again, like, Crowley was basically just ripping him off, but that makes sense because he was actually generating headlines when Crowley was in his early 20s.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. Yeah, one of the things that kind of, there's a couple YouTube channels I watch of, like, practicing esotericists. And as a person who was raised Catholic, like, people invoking archangels kind of turns me off because it just kind of reminds me of church. So, like, a lot of the more contemporary stuff I'm aware of is, like, reconstructed paganism, which wouldn't have worked for the book, clearly, but it's a lot of people being like, yeah, we found a bunch of statues of old Slavic gods in Belarus, and let's start
praying to us.
Let's try to build a religion around that. Let's look at Christian texts in old church Slavonic from the turn of the first millennia and look at all the things they were saying not to do, and then we'll do those things and call that our new religion, our new old religion. One of the things that really excited me about the esotericists in Backmask was how related to science they were, right? Lots of note taking and, like, let's do a thing and see what happens and then adjust from there. And that's the type of alternative spiritual practice that excites me.
That is Thelema.
Right. Yeah. You know, and it's, I don't know, it just seems like you have to do a lot more work to fake things. Whereas, I don't know, I don't want to be mean to anybody, but, like, I don't know, there's certain stuff more in the New Age camp that seems like it's really easy to just pretend like you are at a point.
This is something that I've been interested in for a really long time, and part of the reason why I've been getting into 19th century occultism is to try to find out where that divide happened. I might get in trouble for saying this, but let's find out what happens. So I've actually, like, I've been using Oscar Wilde as the centerpiece for, like, figuring out where that division happened, at least in the English language and in French, like, occultism, because he was in the middle of all of that stuff. He was good friends with William Butler Yeats, who was also a practicing occultist. He was a very, very deeply devout occultist, and Yeats was only able to get Oscar's wife to join the order. I don't remember what the name of them was. Yeah, so he only got Constance to join the actual order, but she wasn't really into it. Neither of them were really that into it. But what Oscar did like were all of the scam artists who were running around in the 19th century, because he thought that they were cool. So he ended up like hanging out with Madame Blavatsky and Theodore Horos and this woman whose name I can't remember, but she is like also like an oddly important figure in occultism because she scammed a bunch of people. He reviewed Dr. Anna Kingston's book, and I wrote an academic article and I submitted it to the Wildian, which is like the journal for Oscar Wilde studies. And they responded 5 minutes after I sent out that email with a rejection. And then the next day they scrounged up, this newspaper article where his son insists that he was a Catholic and posted that on the Twitter page. And I was like, well, if you read the fucking essay, you'd know that I knew that. That was,
that's wild.
Yep.
Oh my God. They must have had like a keyword, like something, right? Like something that immediately flags certain submissions as like, they're talking about esotericism in this one.
Yeah, no, it's literally like, I'm genuinely not kidding. If you look up their editorial masthead, it is a bunch of BBC game show hosts or people who wrote the scripts for them. And I think it's basically just their social club. And they all like to reimagine him as this essentially just like a Tory who was really sad about being Irish and gay. They are rejecting. I'm dead serious. They're rejecting articles that talk about his socialism. They're rejecting articles that talk about his anarchism. And apparently they're rejecting articles that talk about his interest in esotericism. Getting back to the point that I was trying to make, I'm sorry. So he was really into the scam artists, and there are a bunch of apocryphal stories that we can't prove. I don't know if apocryphal is the right word. Anecdotal stories that we can't prove about him, like hanging out with them and like doing some of the bullshit rituals that they were using to control different orders. And I like a lot of people, for example, the podcasters at Lost Podcast on the Left, talk about how a lot of the New Age stuff that has existed into the 20th century is basically just like bad readings of Blavatsky, like the Kybalion, which is kind of the first occult text that is like recognizably 20th century New Ageism, is a rehash of everything that had come out like 50 years prior. And so it's basically like, if we're imagining 19th century occultism as a kind of anthropological study with some practical elements to it, then this is, then what came afterwards were slightly less vigorous readings with a lot more fucking practical elements to it.
Hmm. That's interesting. That's fascinating.
I'm so sorry that took so long.
No, I love it. That's gold. That's why I do the show. I was unaware just how deep you had knowledge of the subject matter. So I'm very pleased to have had that bit of info. That's interesting in a lot of different ways. That it's making my brain want to go in places that are even further away from your writing, so I'm trying to reel myself back in.
It would just end up going into my research, so I mean, like, you are the captain of the ship, and I will let you steer it.
I am. Yeah, okay, that's fine. I just I guess it's giving me like hypotheses that I don't have enough like info. I don't know too much about like, I don't know, earnest, non-culty, new age spirituality to kind of begin to put my thoughts together, I guess, is the thing. I'm curious how you got into all this, because it's been kind of a roundabout way for me. Like, I've always thought that like cults were pretty cool, and I have a really distinct memory of hanging out at my grandparents' years and years and years ago, just like going down a Wikipedia rabbit hole on my phone about Aleister Crowley, and most of that stuff I've forgotten now. And then like very slowly, like trying to get into it and then being afraid that everything I see is just going to be like Atlantis and Aryans and stuff, and then pulling back, and then eventually years ago, a couple of years ago now, finding the Esoterica YouTube channel and kind of developing a reading list based on the books that he recommends and stuff. But I'm curious how you found all of this type of stuff.
I feel like that's a difficult question for me to answer, because I am not sure if like the honest answer is to include like my middle school Wicca phase, because emotionally that doesn't feel right to me, but I feel like there is something valuable in reminding everybody that yes, I was always a spooky little teenager and I can't deny that. And also, you know, there is always the question, just because like I'm an American and I see like the weird way that American spirituality like diverges into either extreme evangelicalism or like this very weird amalgamation of cultural appropriation. And where did that come from? And why are they here? And why are they talking about aliens? What does that have to do with anything? But honestly, like the way that I understand my own personal trajectory into this area of study was that, over the pandemic, I just got really curious about, I mean, actually a little bit before that, I just got really curious about the satanic panic. And that led me into questions about like, not only like where did it come from, but also what was it what emotional truth was it explaining? Because all conspiracy theories ultimately are describing an emotional truth. It's just that they're kind of taking this action adventure path, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was just kind of curious to see what the occultists were saying, how they differentiated themselves from the New Agers. I just never really got into, like, literally just the aesthetics of the New Age. I'm not going to act like I was smarter or better than that. I was just like, why aliens? Like, I don't want to have a spiritual connection to these gray blobs with big eyes. I just don't think that they look cool enough for me to worship. Like, and did that answer the question? Where should I take this?
Yeah. Okay. I think so. That's an interesting way of getting into it. I don't know. My first foray into any sort of religious study that wasn't the religion I was brought up in was like Zen Buddhism. So I was very annoying about that for a couple of years. I wish that I had a teenaged Wicca phase, but my parents would have satanic panicked me, I think.
I had a hippie mom growing up, and she was super into Tibetan Buddhism. And so her whole thing was that she wanted to let me like explore world religion and pick my own path, and I eventually settled on none, but I did really enjoy reading about them.
I really enjoy that I've gotten over reading religious texts as a sales pitch and can just engage with them as literature, because there's so much fun stuff there. You know, it's anybody who likes Warhammer 40K, I feel like, would also be like really into religious studies, because there's tons of names and there's a long timeline and there's a lot of different people and they're all doing weird stuff. But it kind of makes sense, and there's no good guys. I'm I'm pleased that you had kind of a less tumultuous path into it than I did, I guess. But I also find, so I, maybe this dovetails into Lockdown Laureate. I've been having a weird thing lately where part of my like mental spring cleaning, I guess, is listening to music I listened to as a kid a lot more than I normally do. And I was looking into one of my favorite nerdcore hip hop artists, and I was like, oh no, the pandemic made him really weird. And like, not in like it turned him into a, you know, weird mega anti-vax Trumper, but it like took him in the other way, right? Like he's like the very annoying, like I'm still with her sort of person. But on top of that, there's just like lots of live streams of him just like sitting in his car eating a burger silently and just enjoying it loudly.
Mukbang, but just of one burger.
But sad, yeah. Like really, really depressing. And it's like he was like going through a divorce at that time too. So he's like definitely live streaming just to get some camaraderie, but that's just not anyway. Within Lockdown Laureate, there's a piece that kind of talks about how it wasn't necessarily quite so bad for the speaker. And for me, too, I found that lockdown was, like, kind of nice because my wife and I both had to work from home, and so we were in the same place all the time, and our dog was there, and we just ate a lot of burgers, not on the live stream, but we just ate a lot of burgers together. And it's wild to me the ways that that time really affected some people and really kind of didn't affect other people. And I suppose that's part of what Lockdown Laureate's about.
Yeah, just trying to like work through which side I fell on. And I'm still not really sure. But then again, maybe it's not like, you know, a fence in between the two populations.
Right.
I mean, it did literally affect my life, you know? I mean, like, I don't know where you guys are, but I'm assuming you have like a yard. I usually assume that people on the internet I talk to have a yard.
We do, yes.
yeah, so like, you know, going outside was this whole production for us. And yeah, like the people next door were going through this whole thing. And we didn't really know like how to interact with that.
Mm-hmm.
And when we finally moved out of the apartment, like the uncle was just like, hey guys, well, it was nice being neighbors with you. And we were like, yeah. Like, we heard you throw your sister out of the house.
Oh no.
Yeah, but also like at the end of it, like our landlord was like, so do you guys want to renew your lease again? And we were just like, no, I think we're done with this place. We've been here long enough.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, you know, that's tough too. I think we're so fortunate that we were able to find a house and buy it when we did. So like the pandemic was even kind of nice for that because the interest rates went way down and we refinanced our house.
Really good.
And like got a pretty good deal compared to the deal that we had. And I don't know, like didn't really lose any family members. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I was very glad about that. I'm sorry, I just got to knock on some wood.
Yeah. Within Lockdown Laureate, though, there's a lot of stories I really enjoyed. I think it was Dark. That has the.
That's a chunk from, Lord of Thundertown.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it's from a character's perspective that my editor suggested I cut. And I was just really disappointed about leaving this one section, this one scene on the cutting room floor. So I just made it a short story.
That's fantastic. I'm so glad you kept that. I don't Okay, that's not the scene that I was thinking of, but I did enjoy Dark. The Batcave, I think, is the one that has the death room.
Yeah, with Sean and Kate.
Yes. I really liked the geography of that story, how she's just kind of like finding rooms deeper and deeper in this abandoned building. I'm a big fan of any sort of media that has fucked up spaces, and not in like necessarily like a haunted house sort of way, but just like
that's auto fiction.
What's that?
That's auto fiction. That's auto fiction. So if you Google Batcave Gowanus, you'll find the building that I'm talking about.
Oh, cool.
It used to be an MTA electronic transfer. Is that the word that I want? It's like not the power station, but where they would redirect the electricity.
Mm. Okay.
And yeah, like when Kate told us that story, we were like, it's probably just gas. Like you're probably just like there's probably like a broken pipe in there. And she was like, yeah, probably. I'm not going to sleep in there ever again. Salute.
Yeah. My brain was like, oh, there's just no ventilation in the room. And she was like suffocating herself. Yeah. But there were a couple stories in there that kind of, I love the, like, is this supernatural or is this just something weird? In stories, like Gothic literature does that a lot, and there were a lot of pieces in Lockdown Laureate that I really enjoyed. So that was, I don't know, I just kind of figured that that was a lot of writing during lockdown that you then compiled. Looking back
yeah,
at
yeah, but also
say that again.
Also just like it was, but it was also like a lot of pieces of me just being like, man, do you remember when you could run free and you were just out in the Gowanus? And I was like, yeah, that was great. I miss Sean. That the lockdown was also when my best friend moved to Philly to be with his girlfriend, because as soon as he heard that that they were going to be shutting down the highways and stuff, he was like, oh, I got to get to Kim. So he just ran out there. He's been there since.
That's interesting. Did they shut down highways and stuff?
It might have been that he heard that they were going to do that and he moved to Philly just in case they did.
Okay.
He moved out to Philly, all right?
yeah, man. I feel like my memory of that time is really strange. I worked for a morning show at that time, and so I would like hear the last half hour of Coast to Coast before the show started as I was like getting ready for work. And there, he had all kinds of people on there who were like, "There's states you can't even go into anymore. Like, you just can't get into Nevada." And I was like, that seems easily disproven. I feel like I could just test that myself.
I feel like I could drive to Nevada.
Yeah. He's like, yeah, the National Guard has checkpoints everywhere. We had made for us, like, identification cards by the radio corporation I worked for and, like, signed letters in case we needed to, like, actually do checkpoints. It's wild how scary people thought things were going to be, at least in terms of like authoritarianism.
Yeah.
Looking back on Lockdown Laureate now from several years on, how do you feel about those pieces?
I mean, I think that it's less about the pieces themselves and more about like things that I still need to work on in terms of my own writing. I should probably like finish working on my ability to write an ending. But I also need to cut myself a lot of slack, because I feel like the pressure to write something perfect means that I end up deleting something that works just fine.
Yeah. So that's another thing too, is your bio designates yourself as a self-taught writer. So where did the desire to start doing writing come from? And how did you go about figuring out how to do it?
I've been wanting to write since I was a kid. I feel like I have a pretty similar like story about how I wanted to write that a lot of people do, where like, you know, even when I was like one of the games that I would play as a very small child would be I am an author, and I would, like, my parents got me a bunch of blank books that I would draw in. But like, the reason why I say that is because like, I've never been able to actually get like an accredited writing course. I have kind of an inconsistent, actual education background. I'd love for it to be more consistent, but until somebody pays me to do that, that's just not going to happen. So everything that I have has been kind of self-taught. Yeah.
I gotcha. So did you do like the I'm gonna write short pieces and send them to whatever online literary magazine I can find and kind of build your way up from there?
Well, you know what's funny is that was actually my second decision. I did want to write short pieces and poetry when I was a kid, because I got the sense that that was a good way to build up a portfolio. Again, like, nobody told me that that would be a good idea. Nobody told me that I could like just go to poetry readings and say that I was a poet, and that being 21 and a girl was going to get me a hell of a lot of attention. I didn't know that. I would be so much better placed now if I knew that then. So I was like, oh, well, I need to actually have something worth submitting. And I do remember like sending out a couple of very, very, very short pieces while I was still trying to figure out how to write short fiction. And they all got rejected, and I don't have any of them anymore. None of them exist. And so my backup plan, since that wasn't working, was that I was going to write a book, and I was going to send that out to publishers instead of building up my portfolio with short pieces. And so I did that. That was Lord of Thundertown. And when I was done with that, I was like, okay, what now? I guess I'll go back to short pieces. And then the pandemic hit. And for some reason, I guess because I had written something really long form, and the pressure and stress of making something was kind of over, it was much easier for me to pick up the flow of shorter pieces.
That's interesting. So I had written a novel, and then I like sent it to agents, which is very silly to me now. And like nothing happened for a year, unsurprisingly. Right. And so I was like, okay, you know what I better do? I'll just write a bunch of flash fiction and get it all published. And then someone will be like, oh man, do you have a book? Because what I found at one point, once I was like, okay, agents aren't going to work out, so I'm not going to get published by a big publisher. I'll find some indie presses that publish weird stuff. And most of them I found were like, we are not currently taking unsolicited manuscripts. And I was like, oh, so people must just be soliciting manuscripts, which means that there's a bunch of people out there
cut out there for a second.
Oh, did I?
Yeah, sorry, I didn't hear any of that after. Oh, people must.
Okay. Yeah, I was thinking to myself, oh, people must. Publishers, indie press runners, whoever, are out there reading literary magazines and finding people to solicit novels for. So I'll just publish lots of flash fiction pieces. Which was not how I was able to find a publisher for my novel either. But yeah, and I took writing classes too. Like, I don't know if I just didn't take the right ones or whatever, but like, I don't know. I even took like a professional writing class, but that was more like, here's how to write instruction manuals sort of stuff.
Hey, listen, that's a job, and it's a job I'd love to fucking have if anybody wants to hire me doing that. Anyways, I went to AWP this year. And I went to a couple of the the panels that they were having. And everybody was kind of disappointed by the panels this year. And they were like, a lot of this seems to be people just kind of talking about stuff that everyone already knows. Like, everybody was kind of saying the same thing, regardless of what the panel actually was. It was all just like, put yourself out there, make a brand, talk to people, make connections. And that gets a little tiring to hear eventually. And I spoke to this woman who is a professor of poetry after one of her panels. And I just remember, like, it really struck me that the way that she was describing the advice that she was giving, she was like, oh, I know that this sounds really Pollyanna, but you just really have to keep trying. And so after the panel, I was like, can you address the fact that the industry is kind of being killed from the top down? You know, with the fact that, like, none of the people who seem to be in power know how to market their books, and they don't seem to be interested in it. And, like, my wife and I are always talking about the way that the book industry changed after 2008. She's not here, so unfortunately I can't have her come in and be like, here's my theory. But, you know, it's something that a lot of people have talked about. Cory Doctorow wrote a whole fucking book about it. And, you know, she didn't have an answer for me. She was just like, yeah, things are going to be really tough. And, you know, you have to just stick it out. And if you don't stick it out, that's okay. You can always give up. And I was like, it seems to me like the boomers are kind of Pollyanna right now. Yeah. You know, it's just like, keep trying, kiddos. I don't care what the
news says. Somebody will figure it out.
Yeah, somebody. Not me. I don't care what how many degrees I have. I'm not going to think about it.
You know, in the wake of SPD disappearing, I think a lot of people had that state of mind of like, just we're just going to keep trying.
Yeah. And right.
Eventually, the people with the money will notice us.
Yep.
I guess. Yep. I don't know.
This is something that I really do wish a lot more indie authors would talk about publicly. I feel like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize you were talking. I think you might have cut out for a
minute. You're all good.
Okay, I really do think that a lot more indie authors should be talking about this, but I feel like a lot of them don't want to because it ends up reaching like a political space, and so many of them are out here talking about how they have no political agenda, they have no stance, they have no perspective, they have no bias, they are blank slates and the words just appear on them. And like, no, we do have to talk about this eventually. If you don't want to talk about it, then fine, I'll find somebody else to fucking talk about it. And I appreciate Joshua Roth's at Asterism for being somebody who's actually interested in what distribution and sales means. But outside of just like a purely Spartan militant money scheme, like he actually does talk about like, why did he invent a brand new small press distribution when, as far as he was concerned, when he started it, SPD was doing just fine. Like Amazon was paying their authors more than most most of the royalty percentages that any publisher could offer, you know. I think I might have lost my train of thought right there for a second. Is he doing all right, your dog?
The girls are coming home, so he probably saw the car out the window and is excited. So good for him. He's downstairs and behind a closed door, and you can still hear that through the microphone. So that's great fun. Yeah, you know, I have a lot of questions, I guess. I want to say I have a lot of complaints, but I feel like a lot of my complaints can easily be rebutted with like, well, you don't know how X, Y, and Z work. And that's probably true.
Okay, then why can't they tell me how it works?
Right. A lot of the sort of bad taste that's in my mouth has a lot to do with how I feel like it was weird how a lot of people were so unprepared for small press distribution to fold, because damaged book worker first tweeted like December of 2020. And like, I'm out of the loop on everything, and I knew about that. And so when I saw somebody posting, you know, the other day, to date the episode, when SPD just like disappeared, I was not surprised at all. I was just like, oh yeah, that makes sense. That seems like something they would do.
I mean, I remember Alan from Malarkey was, I was asking him what kind of distribution they used. And, you know, when Asterism first got started, he was like, oh yeah, I guess I'll check that out, because SPD is way too expensive for us.
Hmm. And that's interesting to me too, because of it just, I don't know. Like, I feel like a lot of people were just like, oh, SPD is the way to go. They are just the small press distribution. And I don't know, didn't look at what other options were out there. And then, you know, I don't know. I'm hearing things where like people who knew about Asterism and have known about Asterism and just like never got around to switching over are now panicked because they just never got around to switching over. And again, I don't know. Like, I appreciate that people who run small presses aren't business people, right, because I don't know, I make art and not products. But like, if you're going to operate within a capitalist system, you should at least have the basics down for like how it works.
Yeah,
I think
we're getting kind of into personal pet peeves, which I always feel a little weird about talking about, but like, I feel like I see a lot of people talking about what the fuck is his name? The guy who would draw like the weird androgynous little children who had like this whole fantasy scape behind them. Do you know who I'm
Henry
talking
Darger?
About? Henry Darger.
Henry, yeah.
Darger. And the janitor, they found like all of his thrones to God after he died.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I see a lot of people posting that and being like, yep, that's my distribution plan. And I'm like, okay, that seems kind of stupid to me. I mean, good for you. More power to you. You are on Twitter advertising your book, though. So I feel like you've already missed step one, which is to never talk about it ever.
Right. Yeah. I have a, I think we're going to be visited by my daughter. yeah, I try to be generally not abrasive on social media because I can't take it, so I don't dish it, but like,
right.
I tend to have a rule. Hello, darling. I tend to have a rule that like, if you have a Twitter account, you're not an outsider artist. Like, sorry, you're just unpopular or just bad at marketing.
Right.
Like, outsider artists are outside of society, outside of the art world, which means that like no one's gonna know you're an outsider artist until you die. Or like, I don't know, like Viper is probably an outsider musician, and he's on Spotify now, but like he's so completely outside of I don't know, you know, it's like the grandpa who finds who starts a YouTube account and like has like 100 videos and one view on each video or something.
The definition of outsider art is just as difficult as like DIY or small press or indie or whatever it is. It's like, ultimately what we're measuring with these terms is like their distribution. Like, ultimately we're just talking about distribution and sometimes discipline, but sometimes people put a lot of discipline into looking undisciplined and then just do very small distribution. So like, what kind of terms are we using to define any of these things?
Yeah, someone should do a comparative study of new age grifters and and artists, because I think we've circled back around to talking about Backmask, because yeah, I don't know, it just kind of feels the same. I guess the tactics of grifter.
I can loop it. I can square the circle. Okay, so a lot of the reason why we have so many, like, quote unquote subculture music genres right now is because in the 70s, when the music industry was beginning to consolidate into just a couple of really large labels that had all of the money and power to do what the fuck ever, like make videos and pay people to wear costumes and like rent out entire theaters, that was weird for pop culture, you know? Like, the recording musicians changed so much of how we relate to music, and a lot of people disagreed with the direction that producers were taking it, and so they intentionally made a bunch of art that they hoped was either going to be unmarketable, or alternatively some people were just wanting to do something different and were told that it was unmarketable. So like that's what happened with the Ramones. They were just doing what they saw everybody doing when they were 18, and by the time they were 25 and ready to start actually printing music, all of the producers were like, oh, this is too late to be new and too old to be retro, like too new to be retro, too old to be new, you know?
Yeah.
And so Backmask talks about the music industry prior to that switchover.
Yeah, we did it. Woo! Yeah.
This is Chemical Bond from Lockdown Laureate. 1. Hypersexual trauma victims have come to Jesus moments on the strap. They burst into tears during waves of catharsis and project whichever parental figure hurt them most onto her. It made her feel strong to be seen as nothing but a giant, amorphous figure, the stud in a porno while hurt bottoms cried themselves to orgasm. Didn't even get mad when they told her to leave. No eye contact, no kiss. Resetting their boundaries with replacement daddy was the price of admission. She got to push their faces into the pillow, and they got to emerge as tear-stained and proud as a love letter and order her out. 2. The sweat and the short, spiky hairs of a scalp rolled down the back of the neck as they deep-throated her. She could feel their throat contract in spasm around the rod crammed down their throat. Every cough stuttered against her groin. Their face was red and their eyes were puffy and watering, almost like they were going to throw up, but they kept sliding down the rod anyway, like they had a job to do. 3. Bottoms are the best flirts. They run a finger over your arm and tell you about the stars, the three seasons Jung predicted, how Capricorn is ending and Aquarius is beginning. I'm a Taurus. When does that age start? No. Not every sign gets an age. Maybe humanity is just too young. 4. Get a bigger dick. Compensate a little. You've earned it. Life is hard and full of curves, but if you buy a bigger strap, you might get stuck on a corner. I've got the brain disease that makes me think hot people are smaller than me. They're usually not, but if I can fit a waist or a shoulder or a wrist in my hand, it's like some sign that I'm supposed to go for it. Maybe it's a mutual subconscious physical signal. If they let me grab them, they're showing interest. Girl bends down to kiss me, but when both hands go on her waist, brain says little. Like a Napoleonic complex, but Freudian, a complex sex ritual. 5. The conviction of liking something bravely is a sign of fear. Broad-chested, deep-voiced, big manly men deserve poetry, too. They're not cherished in Twitter rants by straight women who talk mostly about being unafraid. They deserve better. They're more than a coward's fetish. They deserve to be made more naked than they have ever been, stripped of their emotional barriers. They deserve a moment's rest from the burden of carrying others. The knots in their back should be broken. They should not just be bare, but raw. Glassy, distant, barrel-chested men slowly returning to their bodies after they reach a place they never knew was available to them. I know a guy who's a fucking coward. He goes along with whatever his friends say. He improves himself by improving his social circle. He's cute, though. I wonder what I could make him agree to. Guys who talk about being psychos have no imagination. They just want to rabbit fuck. Psycho guys are so vanilla. Psycho guys talk about instincts and urges and get confused and afraid when they don't enter fugue states. Never went rabid in a fight. Never disconnected during sex. Totally normal dude staring at his reflection in the mirror with tears in his eyes, wondering why he's not psycho. They read blogs that talk about hormones and nutrition, but nothing makes them disconnect. Nothing frees them from the burden of their own thoughts. And for all their bravado about destroying social norms, nothing would ever make them transgress their own self-image. 6. For a while, she orbited a cute witch. circling her many transparent skirts and scarves, her large black hat, approving of all her tattoos and the heavy bags under her eyes. When she got close, the witch parted some of her fabrics and revealed the mania underneath, the cobwebs of synchronicity tying her in a knot. Self-cocooned, she explained that she held on to herself because everyone else was trying to drain her. Casual encounters in the street and at work knocked down her hit points all day. At night, she wrapped herself in blankets and tried to recover. She poured the leftovers into her craft, little thimblefuls of pure mana into the open cauldron of her art. Every conversation she had made it that much harder for her to get a good cupful. When the pot was full, she poured it out for everyone. 7. Girl in Crocs and no bra came into the deli for a bagel. She scratched, unselfconscious, and the bare length of her spine was revealed for an instant. God, I love that unaware self-possession, so naked and refined. No makeup, hair in a messy practice grace. Cute, tall, slim girl at the cafe in a soft, see-through gray shirt, the bars of her nipple piercings accentuating her tiny little upturned breasts. I want to bite them. The revealed pectoral muscle of a flat chest underneath the protruding, tender breast. 8. Pretty little alt boys with doe eyes and no fear, I'm going to knock you over. Just let me. Let me grab you and shake you and we'll talk about it later. You can be Peter Steele with someone else. Tonight you're Roz Williams. Fine. You can be Iggy Pop. But I want to be David Bowie. No need to change. That faded old band t-shirt has just as many holes as lingerie. Keep all your heraldic symbols on, stolen and pawned from other generations. In pantomime, we are ourselves in the bigger shadows cast on the wall of the cave. The ceremonial ritual of secular self-destruction. Die a little death. Put my hands around your throat. 9. When she's drunk, she wants me to kill her. She wants me to smother her or dig my fingers in her windpipe. She says she doesn't want to die alone. She said she'd prefer if I did it than cancer or a car. She wants me to be there as she goes. She asks if we can jump off the hospice roof when we get old together. She wants to hold my hand on the way down. She likes it when I protect her. She says she feels safe around me. If I tell off a guy, she kisses me on the way home and tells me she loves it when I do that. She asked me to get bigger so I can do it to more guys. She asked me to be her worst nightmare. We'll be right back.